Extortion number 12661, Mr. Jim Ray, reel 19.
Mr. Ray, reel 19. You were telling me about how you were given a card and a pen to send her on arrival back in England. Yeah. Pencil, yes.
Yeah. And the voluntary aid workers, people, they waited. And I filled it in. It was a card saying, "I am in England. I have been wounded," you know, and so and so. And you could tick off these phrases with composed of a few words, you know, and they took it, said, "We will see that this is sent on, put your name and address on," and they were sent straight away home. That was the first communication. Well, my wife then, she knew that I was in England. All the casualties were taken on the train, and we pulled out of the station immediately. Oh, by the way, I've got a cup of tea. A cup of tea along with a cigarette. And it was an enamel mug. And we went to Woking. The train pulled in at Woking. And that's where the hospital was, Woking.
How were you feeling, Bart? Was your back hurting you?
Painful. Oh, I couldn't turn. I couldn't make water. You know what I mean? The pain was severe, right down on the legs and that.
So you'd had no actual treatment yet.
No,
you just bandaged the first
just
time.
Just that bandage.
And it was the same bandage.
The same bandage.
So what did they do at Woking?
Well. Taken into a ward, quite a large, long ward it was, and there were several people already in there when I got in. A couple of nurses that came and undressed me, and turned me over and examined the wound. this time was a bit swelling as well. And brought a trolley in and gave me treatment, like first aid treatment. Cleaned the wound up, cleansed it right round. Put a brand new dressing on and strapped it on. And I got a bed bath, pajamas, clean pajamas, and all that. I didn't see my clothes at all anymore for quite a long time after that. I had difficulty of lying on my back with the wound, you know, I'd sleep on my side of my chest. Anyway, after all that was done, cleaned up, got settled in, I was able to eat a little bit of food supplied. It was scrambled egg and bacon and tea, bread, margarine. And I managed to get something down. I couldn't eat at all because there was pain, you know. I think I must have had half of it. And I think it was on the 28th 29th, 30th. I went between being admitted into hospital. I had to be taken for an X-ray. The X-ray department. And it was rather unusual. There's two that had white coats on, and like orderlies, and put me on a trolley, wheeled me down a long corridor to the X-ray department, put me outside, and walked away, left me, you see. The X-ray department people came, they wheeled me in on the trolley, and I got my X-ray, put me back nice and comfortably, and put me back into the corridor. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when I went to X-ray department, and you know what time it was when I got back in the ward? 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The nurses would keep coming up and down the corridors, you know, and kept looking at me, and I was still there. And one of them came over and said, you've been here a long time, haven't you? I said, yes, of course. Have you had the X-ray? I said, yes, I've had the X-ray. I said, what time did you come? At 9 o'clock. I said, good God, have you been all this time? Where are those orderlies? They should never have been on this task at all. And do you know what they were? There were two from an asylum who were able to do little bits of jobs. They were acting as orderlies. So they just left me there and said, well, that's it, we're being a bit whappy. She says, those two damn people should never have been employed here. And she says, right. She says, well, you haven't had any lunch. Of course, no, I haven't had any lunch, I've had nothing. I'm leaving them in a cup of tea. I wasn't there long, stripped back in the ward, and brought me something to eat, because all the rest of the lads had had something to eat, those who were able to eat, you know, some had to be actually fed, you know, in such a bad state. So there were some very awful states in there. And that was all right, that day passed over, and 2 days later I went in for the operation.
Were you worried about, I mean, you know, being hit in the back, you can have spinal problems, you'd be paralysed.
I did, because the morning after I'd had my operation, put back in the ward, at night time, I couldn't believe this, Peter, and it was night time, the night nurse was on. And she said that I got out of bed very slowly, and I managed to get on my feet, and I was walking from side to side, from bed to bed, and she said, of course I was close to you. She said, you went to the toilet. You went in there, and she says, I waited outside. She said, got out. You came back the same way as you went in. Slowly, slowly, from bed to bed. I had to keep support, you know, where I could. She said, it was all right, Sergeant. She said, I was there. If you'd stumble, I was there to catch you. I said, I can't move my legs. I couldn't move my legs. I couldn't lift my legs. And if I tried to lift them, the pain used to shoot in my back, you know. He said, that's what you did, 1 o'clock this morning. I said, thank God I can walk anyway. I said, I can't lift my legs. She said, that was sheer willpower. I said, I don't know. I said, I can't believe it. She said, that was sheer willpower.
So the operation was just to remove the shrapnel all?
Yeah. It was lodged on the, like the tongue on the, lodged on the bone, the tongue that came out from the side of the vertebrae, third and fourth, between the first and fourth vertebrae. And they put, what they'd done, they took a piece out and they put it in a little round pillbox. If you give it to me the next year, there's a souvenir. That's what came out. And it was no bigger than my fingernail, and about a 1/16 of an inch thick.
It's not big at all.
And it was surprising when that went through my clothing, it let my spine and knocked me 4 yards forward onto my face. The impact. Could you believe that? It cut through my weapon equipment, the back, that was a belt, through a greatcoat, and it nicked a button in my back of my trousers, through me the trouser band, and into the spine. So that you can tell the impact of what a mortar shrapnel can do. Force.
So what about your convalescence after, I mean...
Well, quite a long convalescence. I think I actually... Well, I was examined every day, you know, and dressings and that, because instead of putting spirits on my backside and things like that to stop bed sores, I had them on my chest, because I was lying on my chest most of my time. Until I got on... managed to get on my side and then onto my back, you know, as the pain was getting gradually less. But there's always pain there, you know, anyway. And I think I spent, from May, June, July, and the back end of August, and I know the Battle of Britain was on then, the beginning of the Battle of Britain. I was in the hospital all that time. So it was a very slow recovery from the wound. And when I was discharged...
Did you get any visitors? I mean, were your family able to
come up? Only had one visitor at that time. That was my sister, and she lived at Welland Garden City. She was the only sister anyway of 4 brothers. And she spent a good... nice sunny afternoon with us in deck chair, you know, and talking. And
what about locals? Did they visit at all? You know, people from Woking just come in to see the soldiers?
No. The only visitor I got was, I think it was a colonel. He had like a brass hat and he came. I said,
Colonel Simpson or another colonel?
No, unknown to me. He'd been searching for his son, who was closely associated with the area I was in. It's at just outside of Dunkirk. He had a, during the night, if you remember, he brought an anti-tank gun and 2 men and ammunition through the night. And he was an officer. And he was acting as a gunner as well. That's the situation. And that was his son. He told me what happened. I told him what happened to me, what happened to the battalion. And anyway, when I gave him the description of him, because I saw him for quite a while, you know, dodging about, his height, his description. He says, that's my son. But I've heard nothing of him since then. so we left with 20 packet of fags.
Did you hear anything about your own battalion? You know.
Well, I didn't, not till much later. Quite a lot of them were made captive, prisoners of war. The colonel, Tommy Stoward, RSM, all headquarters would have gone into captivity. Part of my company, and those that couldn't get away, they were surrendered. I heard that my company commander, he lost a leg, or part of his leg, and that was as much as I heard of my battalion, anyway.
So you were in hospital, gradually getting better,
yeah.
Into August, and what happened then?
Well, I was given a leave anyway from hospital. I got decked out in new uniform from top to toe, you know, and I got all my papers, travelling allowances and things so forth, and ration cards. I got a train from Woking to London, then from London up to Durham. Coming towards Durham, Peter, I've seen it many times. When I saw Durham Cathedral Tower, I said, well, I'm home. Because I didn't live far from Durham, the city itself. I thought, here we are. And you know, I still had to have treatment by my own doctor when I went home. I had to go every day for a clean dressing. I was still suppurating, you know, stuff coming out. I got, I think it was fortnight's leave. And I got a letter an urgent letter through the post, and I had to report back to Durham City, Bransworth Castle. That was taken over by the army during the war. That belonged to Lord Boyne. And you had no particular use for the castle at the time. I don't know where he went to, but we used the castle as a reformation of the Durham Light Infantry people who did escape from Dunkirk, a big collecting point. And I reported to the RSM, and the RSM took me to some barracks that had been partially built in Bransworth, and I was from Bransworth.
Just Nissen huts or something?
Eh?
Were the barracks just Nissen huts? Or?
Well, they were just like Nissen huts until the barracks was actually built properly. And I met quite a number of my own battalion that had come back, that managed to escape, and I used to have my meals in the sergeant's mess, and I was there for about 2 or 3 weeks, and I went on a 3-inch mortar course to pass the time away. I also became proficient at driving a Bren gun carrier. And arrived on the.
What did you think of the three? What was the 3-inch mortar course like?
Well, it was a quickie.
It wasn't a proper course then.
Well, it's a course that gave you the rudiments of the ranges, potential of the potential power. The rate of fire, from left to right, the arcs and degrees that it could perform, the base plate, and other points in general, taking, aiming and firing, and setting it up, taking it down, and going through these motions, you see.
Now, were you debriefed at all about what had happened to you, or interviewed, or did anyone talk to you about what had happened to you in France?
No.
In Belgium?
No. No. No briefing. I don't think it was necessary, Peter, because the officers that came back did all the briefing for us. They would know more about it than I did, because there would be officers and men of each company who would get back to England.
Now, how did you feel? I mean, did you think you'd been adequately trained and given the right weapons for the job against the German army at that time? I mean, when you were thinking about it back home, were you?
Oh, yes. We could make full use of all the equipment and...
What about anti-tank weapons? What did you think of them?
Well, the anti-tank rifle, I think that was pretty obsolete from the start. I'd only fired a small calibre shell, armour plating shell, but you had it spot on. You know, you couldn't fire it at an angle, it was because it would ricochet off. That'd be straight on.
Did you ever, I mean, you didn't come up against tanks yourself,
no.
Did you?
No.
So you didn't actually use the boys?
No, but there were tanks operating in the area.
But,
yeah.
But you didn't.
No.
What about the way the Germans used the artillery? How did you know? And air, did that differ from the way the British were using them?
Well, as I said, there was a scarcity of artillery because they'd been. You could understand. I could understand it anyway, of being an NCO. That artillery and weaponry be used in places of necessity. It wasn't used in discrimination. It was for putting a heavy bombardment where there was tanks, where there was heavy armour, and where there were deep concentrations of troops. That's what the artillery would be doing. See.
What did you think of the way your officers and the colonel had performed during the actions, during the retreat, and then?
All right, all doing. Hello, my company commander, because apart from we having a coming to rest, you know what I mean, he had to scoot up to the BHQ and find out what was going off and come back. And he practically didn't get any rest at all, and he was pretty tottering, you know what I mean, when he's on the march. It's exhausting.
Yeah. Did they all do their duty yet? I mean, there was no complaints from the men?
No complaints.
What about the NCOs? Did they perform well?
Yes, of course.
So you felt that from the bit what you'd seen, that the DLI had done well, the battalion had done well?
Under circumstances, very well. I don't think anybody could have done any better. They fought well, orderly, no shenanigan, no bloody panic, got down to it steadily, gradually. When you get the first baptism of fire. When you get that over, you know exactly what to expect, and you can meet it. You can meet it more calmly. You gradually you get into it, just like a machine.
So, leaving that aside now, you were at Brandsperth and you're doing a course and Bren driving and thing, Bren carrier. What happened next?
That was only field timing. Well, there's nothing else I could train for, really. These are the things I hadn't been trained for before, you see. And I did that to suit myself. I'm not short. I went into the classes just to take part, listen, learn, digest, and go through the actions. Same with the brain gun carrier. Used to go in the countryside, rough terrain, up pit heaps and down and things like that, you know.
Didn't that give you back some, Jim?
Oh, it did, yes. Especially with it bouncing around, curving around.
Were you fit? What was your physical grade? I mean, were you back to, doesn't sound like you were back to A. Hey.
Peter, I couldn't sit on an upright chair with my back resting against it for a long, long time. I had to sit side saddle. It was that painful. And I still, we'll come back to Bransworth after that bit of training for just for my benefit. Interest, that was all it was for, to put time in, you know. And
so you were nowhere near fit at the time? I mean, with your wound?
Well, I was walking all right, except the pain. That was the only thing that troubled me. And I got a message to go to the holding group, which is situated at Claypath. It was an old drill hall. And I had to go on an interview with, I think it was Major Harry Lowe. While I was in there, there was another sergeant. I think I mentioned his name before.
Stewart, I think you mentioned.
Stewart.
Would that be right?
Jackie Stewart, Sergeant Stewart, yes. We went in together, and he said, well, there's a job of work come through for you two people. So, what is it, sir? Apparently, you've been chosen to go into the colonial staff. So I said, what is that? Well, what's that mean, sir? I said, well, he said, with the qualifications, he said, we're going to send you to going to West Africa. He says, you want to train African troops on the colonial government side. And I said, oh, yeah. And he says, you've been selected anyway. So from here, he said, you'd have 72 hours leave, and I want your names and addresses anyway, and took them. He says, you'll be notified where to report to. He says, you'll get all your papers. They'll come through by post, and it'll be very, very quick. And I had 72 hours. In less than 72 hours, the postman at the door, envelope came through. We had to go down to London.
Now, how did you feel about that? Because the 2nd Battalion was being reformed in England. You know, I know it was been smashed up, but it was being rebuilt. It was down in Yorkshire somewhere at the time. Yeah. Did you not want to rejoin them?
Of course I did. I wanted to go back to my own battalion, but I didn't get the chance. And why you sent in the army, who's to wonder why you ask questions? You've got to obey orders.
How did you feel about the prospect of going into the colonial forces and going to Africa?
Very badly. I had done a lot of travelling before I went to West Africa, and I said, oh dear, that's me.
What didn't you like about the idea of it?
Well, I wanted to be on my own side, but I didn't want to go abroad anymore. I wanted to be in my own battalion. I wanted to carry on soldiering with the battalion for as long as the war existed.
What was so wrong with West? Did you worry about being sent to West Africa, or was it just that it was the wrong? It wasn't the DLI.
No, I wasn't worried. I think I could go anywhere, but I wanted to go back to my unit.
What about if they'd sent you to a territorial unit? Because they did that with some of the sergeants.
I'd be all right. I could have coped with that easy.
You'd have rather that?
Yes, I'd rather go to any territorial battalion.
Of the DLI?
I would have got, yes. Peter, I would have gone to any unit in the British Army if I'd been sent.
So it was being sent to another unit, to the West, Royal West African Frontier Force, yeah, that put you back up?
Yeah, because I didn't know what it was like at all, you know what I mean? I knew that prior to the war, World War II ever been thought about, I knew that at least two of our officers had a spell in British West Africa for experimental reasons, I should think, more than anything, it's for a short term of duty, you know. Tommy Studlett, excuse me, Peter. Tommy Studlett, he did a stint in West Africa, and he had yellow fever while he was there, and he came back. Lieutenant Forrester, he was in our battalion. He went, he did a stint over there, and he was in the transport officer.